Okay. So there are approximately 60 different calendars around the world. I'm not referring to little desk things, you know, the Redneck calendar and the Farside and Calvin and Hobbes. I mean systems of measuring the progress of time. The three main systems are, of course, the solar, the lunar, and the lunisolar, not with two O's, but of the U, right? As in lunisolar, it doesn't matter. So anyway, as you probably know, the secular world, the Western world, uses a solar calendar. Solar calendar means the following, that you have the four seasons of the year. You have a year, meaning the amount of time for the sun to go through that cycle, the earth and the sun go through the cycle of the four seasons, get back to the place where it was. That's about 365 and a quarter days, approximately. And then you have, but of course, in that system, there's really only the year exists. There's an artificial division of that year into 12 months. But the months don't have any relationship to any natural cycle. Okay, it's a division into the 12 months, which was based on the lunar, but it's really, like, for instance, when January starts, it won't be the new moon. And the middle of January is not necessarily the full moon. And the end of January, so there's no relationship of that month to any solar cycle. And the sun itself, by the way, doesn't really have any cycles. There's an 11-year solar spot cycle, which if you operate a ham radio, excuse the expression, you will know, because it interferes with the reception. But otherwise, there's not really a cycle in the sun that you can see that is apparent, right? So the so basically you have the sun, same old, and seasons, and you have the yearly solar calendar. The solar calendar has to be adjusted many times because, you know, since it's 365 and a quarter days, you're going to have problems. So it was adjusted a few times. Julius Caesar adjusted it and added, I forgot what it was, 80 days or something like that. Later on, Pope Gregory adjusted it and he declared the next, you know, it was I think July 17th. He said, no, it's not. Tomorrow's going to be August 17th, something like that. Right, so now we have what's called the Gregorian calendar. So you've got the Julian calendar and you've got the Gregorian calendar and you've got various adjustments that were made, and that's the more or less the solar calendar. That was an ancient calendar. The Egyptians used a form of solar calendar as well. Then you've got, on the other extreme, you've got the lunar calendar. So the lunar calendar operates based totally on the observation of the new moon. When there's a new moon, it's a new month. When there is no moon, there's no month. Right, and indeed in the lunar calendar, or it's the end of the month, right? In the lunar calendar, there's not really a year. In other words, it's decided that the 12 lunar months will be a year, but the natural cycle of the lunar calendar is the moon. That's it. The Muslims, for example, use a totally lunar calendar. And in the lunar calendar, the time it takes the 12 cycles of the moon ends up with a 354 and a half day year. So that's 11 days less than the solar calendar. Okay, what that means is that let's say you're keeping a lunar calendar and someone else keeping a solar calendar and you're both starting off the same point. What will happen is that your seasons, you'll be out of sync with the seasons. Is that clear? Right? In other words, so that means if you are highly unlikely, if you're a religious Muslim, don't put up your hand if you're, right, a religious Muslim, then you'd be observing like Ramadan and the other festivals, Eid and stuff like that, you'd be observing them in virtually every season of the year over the course of your life, right? Because it will drift, so to speak, over the course of the seasons. So that is the totally lunar calendar. So as we know, the Jewish calendar is what I would call lunisolar, L-U-N-I-solar. It is both. Meaning, our month starts with the new moon. The middle of the month is the full moon. And when you can't see the moon, right, it's the end of the month. And not only that, but because, so that's because the Torah says, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. The Torah, really, it's interesting, the Torah only says two statements about the calendar. Two statements. It says, this month shall be for you the first of months. That's, as I've got here, comment with Nachmanides in Exodus, Shmois 12. This month will be for you the first of months. And the other thing the Torah says is, Shamor et Chodesh Ha'aviv, guard the month of spring. Now from this you're meant to develop a calendar? How can you do that? So Ibn Ezra, in his introduction to Chumash, points out this is clearly something where we need additional information, which is what the oral law is. The oral law, given together with the written law, gives us the additional information about the calendar, which is a vast amount of information. You can't develop a calendar based on those two verses. Guard the month of spring, and this is the first month. But what we learn from these two verses, very basically, is that the month is determined by the moon, but it must be adjusted also for the solar calendar. We want our festivals to fall in the appropriate season. So that means, since there's the 11-day discrepancy, what do you have to do? You have to adjust it. Over the course of 19 years, 19 times 11, right, what you'll have is a period of approximately a 7-month discrepancy between the solar and the lunar calendar. Which means, over the course of 19 years, we add 7 months to the calendar. Hence, in a Jewish leap year, it's not just an extra day, it's an extra month. So Adar Aleph, the first month of Adar, is added in a leap year. And consequently, over the course of 19 years, within that 19 years, you'll have 7 years, which will be 13-month years. And the rest of them will be 12-month years. So that but principally, the Jewish calendar is not based on the sun, it is based on the moon, it's just adjusted for the sun. Is this clear so far? Okay. Now, since also the actual length of the lunar month is really 29 and a half days, I'm giving this approximately because it's down to the second and stuff, but it's about 29 and a half days, that means you can't have a half day in the calendar, so that means you've got to have some months will be 29, some months will be 30, so that you'll compensate, right? So therefore, that's also part of the calculation that has to be done. So we have a few calculations. A, the first of the month has to coincide with a new moon, 15th of the month, the full moon, end of the month, no moon. And we are looking at the moon. We have witnesses in the days of the temple. People would look at the moon. They'd go to the temple. They'd testify to the appearance of the new moon. Even today, in Shul, actually, Shabbos Mevorachim, which we bless the new month. And the Gabbai announces the appearance of the Molad, right? Which, for some reason, they always do in Yiddish, even though no one in the Shul understands Yiddish, even though the Gabbai is basically, at the point of fainting, trying to actually say it in Yiddish. But nevertheless, this is something deep and mystical, I'm sure. Right, and so we do it in Yiddish. But the announcement of the new moon, so the exact time of the appearance of the new moon over, right, in the world, is the... that's the whole calculation. I don't get into that because there's a whole discussion about where that is and the Jewish date line and what that is. And you probably didn't know there's a Jewish date line, right? There's a halachic date line because the international date line is 180 degrees from Greenwich. This may come as a shock, but Greenwich is not holy according to Jewish tradition, right? Even Greenwich in England, where the Royal Observatory was, nevertheless has no sanctity. So therefore, we would consider 180 degrees from Greenwich to be a totally arbitrary point at which the day starts. So where does the Jewish day start is actually a matter of major dispute between various authorities, the Chazon Ish, Rav Yitzhak Isaac Herzog, Rav Aaron Kotler, and others hotly debated this. It first became a debate when the Mir Yeshiva from Lithuania escaped from the Nazis with the help of Japanese consul Sugihara and got visas to go via Japan they were supposed to go to Indonesia, I think it was. Right. In the end, they got to Japan and they went to Shanghai and they spent the war in Shanghai. And there were a lot of tremendous amount of divine providence involved in that. And they survived the war in Shanghai. But they were in China initially, in Kyoto. There was a meeting between them and the Japanese foreign minister. And there was an interpreter. There was a professor of Semitic languages in Tokyo University who spoke Hebrew. And so he was interpreting with the people from the Mir Yeshiva and the Amshinova Rebbe and others and the Japanese foreign minister. So now, I'm guessing their standard language was Yiddish, not Hebrew, but they could speak Hebrew, right? And this Japanese professor is studying biblical Hebrew so he could understand them, and he's translating into Japanese for the Japanese foreign minister. It was totally interesting. The story is told, it's actually someone who... his father was there, told me that it's true, is the Japanese foreign minister asked the unction of a Rebbe, Hasidic Rebbe. He says, most Rebbes are Hasidic, I think. Anyway, so whatever. So he asked the unction of a Rebbe, he says, why do the Germans hate you so much? So the unction of a Rebbe, Pius Streimel, the beard, he says, look, he says, we Jews are from the Middle East. That's the Orient. You know how these Europeans hate us Orientals. Right, and the foreign minister liked the answer. But anyway, when they were in Japan, there arose a question as to what day they should observe Shabbos, Yom Kippur, and stuff like that. Because according to the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Jewish dateline, halachic dateline, is the easternmost coast of China. If it means it's the easternmost coast of China in Japan, what day should you keep Shabbos? Saturday night, Sunday. And the same would be true of New Zealand. Right, so Saturday night, Sunday. So the Chazon Ish sent them a telegram, which got there the day before Yom Kippur, which on that year I think was a Wednesday or something, I don't remember. And he said, eat tomorrow, fast the next day. In other words, the day that everyone else in the world was keeping Yom Kippur just about, right? And he said, don't keep Yom Kippur that day, eat. He said, you do it the next day. So it's like, whoa, right? And there are a lot of others who argued. There are other rabbis who argued with this. And of course, there were groups. Some kept it that day. Some kept it the previous day. Some did both days, right? To this day, it's a matter of argument. I know, for instance, members of the Lakewood Kollel in Melbourne, Australia, when they visit New Zealand, since they follow Rav Aaron Kotler, they keep Shabbos, indeed, on Friday night, Saturday, as do the Jews in New Zealand. But many of them are machmir, stringent, not to do work on Sunday, out of respect for the view of the Chazon Ish. Okay, so anyway, this is a little bit of a close parenthesis. You can start listening again. So now, we have this, the first day of the month is the new moon, etc. So now, it is interesting to note that this was the first mitzvah that God gave to the Jewish people as a people. Rashi points that out, right? The Jewish people come out of Egypt, or about to come out of Egypt, God says to the Jewish people, Shamor es Chodesh Aviv, and he says, Chodesh Hazeh Lachem, Rosh Chodoshim, this month shall be for you the first of months. And as the Ramban points out, in source number one, this is the first mitzvah that God commanded the Jewish people through Moses, to count the first of months as the month we came out of Egypt, and all the months counted from this month, first, second, third, etc. That's why, and I always, you know, a lot of Jews who are very distant from Judaism find it very confusing when I tell them that the new year is on the seventh month. I mean, this does sound a little strange, doesn't it? You know? And of course, they get impressed when we tell them we have two New Year's Eves, right? So they say, wow, amazing stamina, man. Right? So actually, we spend the whole time in synagogue praying, and they said, whoa. Right? So, but again, it's a strange thing, but it's on the seventh month, because the first month for us is the month we got out of Egypt, which is Nisan. In fact, there's actually a mitzvah to count the months from Nisan, just like there's a mitzvah to count the days of the week from Shabbos. There's no names for the days of the week in Israel, you know that? No names in Hebrew for the days of the week. They are called first day from Shabbos, second day from Shabbos, third day from Shabbos. And every time we say, today is, what is it today? I forgot. What are Yom Sheni b'Shabbos? It is Yom Sheni b'Shabbos. That means it's the second day from Shabbos. I am fulfilling the biblical commandment of remember the Sabbath day. So every time I do that, remember that. And every time I say Shabbat Shalom, or Good Shabbos, I'm fulfilling that commandment. So and indeed, when I say that now we are in the month, the 10th month, I say I'm in the 10th month now, I'm fulfilling that biblical commandment of counting from that first month, because we'll always have a remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt when we do that. However, it is a little strange, isn't it, that the first mitzvah that God would give to the Jewish people is the calendar? I mean, if I was starting a religion, United Church of Becherology, or something like that, right? So I don't think the first thing I'd say to people is, okay, folks, change your calendars. No more of this Outlook rubbish. We're using something else, right? I mean, what is it? I mean, first mitzvah I'd probably say is give me your money, right? But I mean, what is the idea of the first thing to say to the Jews is, new calendar, it's new calendar. Why? Obviously, I mean, it's clear. There must be something very central about the idea of this calendar if this is going to be the first mitzvah God gives to the Jewish people. And I think it's going to be more than pragmatics. I mean, how can you have festivals if you don't have a calendar? Well, that's true. But so give me another command, then give me the calendar. Or something. Why is this so central? I think it's important to understand this. So, and I think it's related to the fact that the Jews are coming out of Egypt. You see, the Egyptians, they have the solar calendar, which I described before. When you think about it, there's a very big difference between a calendar that follows the moon and a calendar that follows the sun. And I think the difference is the following. And it's found in the Hebrew language. The Hebrew word for month is chodesh. Chodesh is the same as the word. It's the same root as chadash. What does chadash mean? It is new. New, chadash, new. Interesting to note, year, which is the only unit in the solar calendar, year is shana, which is, as the Radak and others say, related to the word shinun, which means repetition. Yashan, which means old. Sheni, which means second. Yashen, which means to sleep. What is the common factor amongst the words of month and amongst the words of the year? The common factor is the year, the words denote nothing new, correct? Repetition, old, sleeping, right? Second. In the word for month, it's chadash, which is new. There's a verse that says in Koheles, Ecclesiastes, famous verse, Ein chadash tachat hashemesh. There's nothing new under the sun, right? What does that mean? What it means is, you see, the solar year represents the system of teva of nature. It represents a deterministic system in which what was will be, and nothing's really going to change. The Egyptians, we are the ant pants and the bee's knees of creation. We are the center of the world. It revolves around us. We are superior, in a word. You Jews are the pathetic, untouchable, whimpersoid slaves. Right? And you will remain so forever. Right? However, that was based on the idea that Ein Chadash Tachas Hashemesh is nothing new under the sun. We are created based on the idea that of Chidush. And what do I mean by Chidush? The central thesis of the whole creation of the world was only for the power of chidush, of newness, of recreation of the self, of doing something new. And this goes back to a very, very important idea. The Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, asked this question. Very famous question. He asks it in his book, Magid Meisharim, which is a book he wrote, Conversations with an Angel. He really actually had conversations. There was an angel who would come to him, he'd ask him questions, and he'd give him answers. He recorded the answers in his book, Magid Meisharim. Fascinating book. So the question he asked the angel was the following. Why is there a world? In other words, he says he knows that which many, many of the commentaries tell us and is implied in verses in the Torah, Olam Chesed Yibaneh, the world was created for God, the perfectly good being gives. As the word, in the words of the Ramchal, in the beginning of Derech Hashem, the way of God, he says, Derech Hatov Lehetiv, it's the way of the good to give. So if it's the way of the good to give, God created so he can give goodness to us. Ultimate perfect good. But the question you have to ask then is, why make me go through this world? Just give it to me. Just give it to me. Example, let's say someone comes to you, comes over to me and say, Mordechai, I understand it's your birthday. I say, yeah, thanks for remembering. And he says, yeah, I've got a present for you. I said, whoa, wow, really nice. He hands me the present. Of course, then you have the great moral dilemma, hotly debated by ethical philosophy, as to whether you should open it now or wait, right? Because if you open it now, right, you will have to hide your disappointment when it's something you didn't like, and it's like very hard to be sincere, right? And it shows maybe too much greed, etc. On the other hand, if you don't open it, maybe you're not showing enough enthusiasm, and maybe they feel maybe he doesn't trust me, he thinks I'm going to go into something he doesn't like, and that's why he's not opening it now, because he doesn't want to hide his enthusiasm. And then you've got this whole like conflict, and you're both standing there like anxiety, this, you know, perspiration pouring down, right? You're just like, what do we do? Anyway, so you decide, you come down on the Kantian side that you should open it, because truth is the ultimate, right? So you open the, I open the little, it's a little box and it's beautiful wrapping paper which I rip. That's also some deep psychological issues there about ripping wrapping paper, because when I was a kid, my mother would always tell us, don't tear the paper. Right, I guess we'd reuse it or something like that. We're ecologically conscious, a green household, you know, like the Gores or whatever. So is that, don't rip the paper now. I deliberately rip wrapping paper as much as I can. I mean, it's like it's something like a psychological release to me. I buy rolls of wrapping paper and just rip it. I'm the serial ripper, Mordechai the Ripper. So anyway, so I tear the wrapping paper and... I'm ranting. So I open up the box, and in the box, there is a key. I said, you know, trying to be polite and say, well, thank you, it's a beautiful key. And I like those little grooves there, right? And he says, oh, no, that's not your present, Mordechai. I said, oh, really? He said, no. Your present is actually in a safety deposit box. The key is the key to the safety deposit box. He says, the present's far too expensive for me to carry around. This is the key to the safety deposit box. Now, I'm a little more sincere, and I say, wow, thank you so much. That's really nice. That's very, never had that before. And I say, wow, that's great. Thank you very much. I said, where's the bank? He says, it's the Central Grozny Bank. I said, Grozny? Isn't that in Chechnya? He says, yeah, it's capital. How am I meant to get to Chechnya? Chechnya, for heaven's sake. He says, well, look, you get a flight to Moscow, you know, go to the Sheremetyevo airport, and from there, you know, you can get a commercial flight, Air Chechnya, to Chechnya. So I have to fly Air Chechnya? Remember, you know, before the new Ben-Gurion airport was built, you know, you used to actually land and go down the stairs onto the actual tarmac in Israel. People used to see people kissing the ground because it's the Holy Land. There are certain airlines, doesn't matter where the heck you land, you'll kiss the ground. Right? Now, you land in Newark, New Jersey, with the radon gas and the toxic waste, you'll still kiss the ground because you were flying Air Chechnya. You know what I mean? It's like, so, okay. So he says, okay, you get Air Chechnya. I said, okay, fine. Okay. So he says, if you make it to Chechnya, if I make it, he says, no, you'll be fine. Right? And so he said, I say, how far is the bank? He says, about 30 miles. I said, oh, that's not too bad. 30 miles is not such a big deal. He says, however, the first 10 miles is actually, there's a cordon of Russian Spetsnaz troops. I said, Spetsnaz, aren't they the elite commando unit of the Soviet army? Right? Extremely vicious commandos, underpaid. He said, yes, you've got it correct. I said, oh my God, I have to fight my way through 10 miles of vicious Russian commandos who don't have a good paycheck. He says, okay, well, yeah, that's true. But I said, and what about the next 10 miles? He says, the next 10 miles, not controlled by the Spetsnaz. I said, thank God for that. He said, oh, I said, who is it controlled by? He says, Islamic fundamentalists. I said, great. So now we've got underpaid and vicious Russian soldiers. We've got underpaid, vicious, and crazy fundamentalists, right? And that's another 10 miles. And I said, in the next 10 miles, he says, controlled by neither. I said, oh, that's great. Right. You know, I'm a little suspicious. Who is it controlled by? He says, the Russian mafia, worse than both put together. He says, okay, so if you make it through those 30 miles and you get to the bank, he says, just be careful because the actual safety deposit box is booby-trapped. If you turn the key the wrong way, goodbye. You wouldn't happen to remember which direction. He says, I've got a digital watch. I don't remember if it was clockwise or counter. So he says, you'll have to experiment here. Experiment! Well, 50-50 chance. I mean, what would you say to someone after giving you such a present? I mean, I would say, heavily censored version of what I'd say, but I would say, you know what, next time don't get me a present. Just send me one of those stupid, you know, email things. You know, click on the link, real personalised, you know, type of things. I love getting those, right? Just click on the link. You know, so-and-so has sent you a personalised card, right, where you have Kermit the Frog singing dreidel, 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 right? I actually got one of those. Right, so, but on the other hand, that's probably preferable to fighting your way through 30 miles of war-torn Islamic, you know, fundamentalist-ridden, Spetsnaz commando-protected, Russian mafia-infested, booby-trapped Chechnya. Right, I mean, I think I'd prefer a little e-card where I press on the link. I mean, the worst thing you can get is a virus, big deal. Right, I mean, but... So, this is more or less what Rabbi Yosef Kara asks. I'm taking some really... liberty in translating the original Aramaic, but more or less, this is his question. God wants to give me a present. He wants to give me goodness. He wants to give me a relationship with God. He wants to give me closeness to God. So, why doesn't he just do that? Why do I have to go through this world? I mean, everything, beginning to end, it's a lot of struggle. Right, failed paper cutting in kindergarten, held back in pre-1A, right, the whole works, you know, then you've got bullies in the class, and then you've got high school, and you've got acne, and whatever, and then you've got college, and you've got taxes, and then, the whole works, is unbelievable, right, just give me the present, make me slip through this world. The answer is really a two-word answer, which the angel gives him, which we have to explain further, but it's Nahama de Kisufa. Nahama, it's Aramaic, it means bread of shame. Bread of shame. What does bread of shame mean? What it means is that which you have not earned, that which you have not worked for, that which you have not struggled for, is not really a complete good. It is bread of shame. It's like receiving a handout. It's like getting food stamps. It's like getting charity. It's an embarrassment. There's a humiliation in that. It's not something I've earned. It's not something I deserve. It's not really good. It's not a perfect good. Of course, and therefore you have to struggle for it. Now, we could ask another question at this point. So don't create me with a sense of humiliation. Then I won't have to worry about it being an imperfect present. I mean, there are plenty of people out there who have no shame, right? I can name them a few, there's plenty of people that they get a handout, they'll be more than happy. Great, I didn't have to struggle, I didn't have to work. In fact, that's probably the standard view in the Western world today. People think you're an idiot if you actually work honestly for something, right? They think that the person who actually gets something without working, the person who avoids all the problems, avoids issues, doesn't struggle, etc., etc. Oh, he is a good guy. He made the money, skirting the edge of legality, etc., but he didn't have to work and stuff like that. We look down on it. It's actually the antithesis of what it should be, isn't it? What it should be is there's a respect for that struggle, a respect for that work, and a respect for overcoming adversity, and a dignity in actual labor, right? But why is it so? The reason it's so is because Hashem created man, B'tzelem Elokim bara et ha'adam. The human being was created in the image of God. What does it mean in the image of God? As God is self-contained, as God, everything he does comes from within, nothing comes from outside of him. So the human being also has a similarity to God in that the good has to come from within. Because to be compatible with God, to have a relationship with God, requires similarity. You cannot have a pleasurable, in other words, I would say the degree of pleasure in a relationship is directly proportional to the degree of spiritual, emotional compatibility and closeness of the two parties. I had a dog for 13 years when I was a kid. There are obviously limits to the degree of our relationship. I enjoyed MASH on television. He only watched the Alpo commercials, right? I mean, the rotting bones in the garden that have been buried there for 3 days, not really something which turns me on in any way, right? I mean, I prefer them after 1 day, usually maximum, right? So, but obviously we have very different... Right? So in order to have a relationship and joy in the relationship requires level of compatibility. Example, Coca-Cola had a competition a while back, In which they often have these competitions. You open the bottle, and you look in the cap, and it says a winning code word, or it says try again. I had a guy at my house for Shabbos once. He opens the Coke bottle, he looks in, it says try again. So he closes it and he opens it again. And he says, like, dude, this is not working, you know. Like, so anyway, the winning prize at the time was 1 week. If you won this competition, you get 1 week touring with the Backstreet Boys. You've probably never heard of them. They're ostensibly a musical group, right? And in order to enjoy, you need to wear clothing 8 times too big, wear your cap backwards, and have extensive facial piercing, preferably through the frontal lobes of the brain, right, to give you a true appreciation of their music, right? But in any case, the first prize in this competition was... a week with the Backstreet Boys. You could get a chance to spend time with them backstage, serve them drinks, no doubt other pharmaceuticals, right? And this would be the first prize. So I was imagining to myself, I often imagine bizarre things, I was imagining to myself the following, right? At the time, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra was playing in Newark. The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan, the great German conductor, the Berlin Philharmonic. I have a series of CDs he did on Beethoven concerts, Berlin Philharmonic, Herbert von Karajan. I blast them when I'm coming back late from a class, keep myself awake in the car, blast, this Beethoven, like the top. I have the great pleasure of people pulling up next to me at a traffic light, some guy in a pimped-out ride with Snoop Dogg blasting, asking me to turn down my classical music so he can hear the rap. So anyway, it's a perverse joy of getting there. So anyway, what happens is Herbert von Karajan is conducting the Berlin Philharmonic, and I imagine the following scene. He finishes the concert, he struts backstage, goose-steps over to the machine, and he feeds in some Deutschmarks, and he gets a Coke. He opens it up. Of course, he looks in the lid. He looks at it and he says, "Oh, so, I have won the competition. Let me ask you something. Would a week with the Backstreet Boys for Herbert von Karajan, would that be first prize or a condemnation to the depths of hell?" The answer is B. Okay, I think clearly there are certain combinations of people. It's very hard to imagine that the combination would give any pleasure to either party. Right? A jam session with Snoop Dogg and Yo-Yo Ma is not something which one can really contemplate. Right? It's hard to see them together in any way. You know, Chazen Helfgott and Matis Yahu joint concert. Right? It's hard to see. Right? So, therefore, in order to, for us, this is based on the Ramchal, although again I'm taking liberty with his translation, right? But in order for us to have a relationship with God, with the Creator, requires compatibility. I mean, otherwise, what will be the place? Someone who totally identifies with the material, someone who doesn't have any concept of spirituality, of morality, of ethics, etc., someone like that, how could they have a relationship with God? Someone has also misunderstandings about God. If you don't know, you know, can you have a normal relationship with someone if you deep down believe this person is an alien, like from another planet, right? And they've got this like rubber mask, right? How can you have a normal conversation? You're always wondering, are they going to like eat me or anything or take over the planet? I mean, how can you, if you think the wrong, or if the person you are speaking to, you believe they have multiple personality disorder, right? You're speaking to Sybil, right? Or you're not sure which one you're talking to at the moment. I don't know, you know. That you cannot have a normal relationship. If you have misconceptions about God, if we have major dissimilarities and distance, we cannot enjoy the gift of the goodness of God's presence. If everything you love, enjoy, respect, honor, want, desire, etc., is embodied in God, then obviously closeness to God is going to be an incredible good, a perfect good. But you've got to be compatible. Compatibility requires that whatever we do, which brings us to that, comes from within, not from outside, correct? Because just as God, the good comes from within, because there's nothing outside of God. Ein od milvado, there is nothing beside God. Emet malkeinu efes zulato, our king is true, there is nothing beside him. Therefore, everything he does comes from within him. So that means for us to be God-like, to be compatible, to be similar, what does it require? Where does the good have to come from? It must come from within. Must come from within. For the good to come from within requires that I be in an environment in which it's possible that I do not good. Correct? If I was in an environment in which everything was predetermined and inevitable, in which I was a captive of the laws of nature, cause and effect, heredity, environment, upbringing, etc., in which it was inevitable that I would act in a particular way, then that doesn't come from within me, that comes from sources outside of me, correct? If I was pre-programmed, it's not me. I'm not doing it. Someone else is doing it. If that's just my instinct, then, again, I'm not godlike. If your instinct is only good, if you have no desire to do anything wrong, if you never make mistakes, if from the moment of your birth, you're perfect, that's not godlike, actually. Because all the good and anything you do doesn't come from within, it comes from outside of yourself. Totally outside of yourself. Right, this is what's called Sinatra Principle. Named after Frank Sinatra, the great American philosopher. As you probably know, I think it was Aristotle who said, to do is to be. Shakespeare said, to be or not to be. Jean-Paul Sartre said, to be is to do. Frank Sinatra said, do be do be do. Right? However, what he also said was, on a deeper level, he said, probably his most famous song, I did it my way. I did it my way. No doubt, he was alluding to Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto's principle here. And I did it my way means that the good has to come from within me, in an environment in which I am able to choose and to create something totally new. When it says that we are created in the image of God, B'Tselem Elohim, Reb Chaim Volozhin, in his book Nefesh HaChaim, at the very beginning, points out to us that what that means is we are creators like God. We have the power of creation, chidush, to create something new. The natural world, predetermined. Ein chadash tachas ha-shemesh, nothing new under the sun. But in the supernatural world, lamala min ha-shemesh, above the sun, in the world of spiritual supernature, there is possibility of chidush. We can recreate ourselves, we can recreate the world, we can be creators as well, like God. And it can come from within us, from the pure, unfettered ratzon, free will of the human being. That is the essence of our calendar. So we look at the moon and focus on that. What does the moon tell us? Chidush. Renewal, rebirth, recreation. You look at the sun, it is same old, year in, year out. Ein chadash tachas ha-shemesh. The first thing God tells us, the first mitzvah he gives to us is, the month shall be for you the first of months. Look at the moon. Understand that you are not prisoners of time, you are in control of time. You create, you are not coerced, as Samson Raphael Hirsch puts it. Number three, the truth which the calendar teaches forms a foundation stone of our Jewishness. It differentiates it most sharply from all paganism. The pagan knows no newness, not in the world, not in humanity, not in his gods, not in the powers he places above men in the world. Everything is bound by cast iron necessity. To him, all todays are evolved from yesterdays. Every tomorrow must with absolute certainty follow from today. Just as he denies creatio ex nihilo, the free creation by a free will of a creator, there is also, he says, no ex nihilo, creation of nothing from something, or something from nothing in the moral nature of man, no creation in the fate of man. Guilt and evil forever beget guilt and evil. For him, nothing of the godlike freedom dwells in the heart of man. For him, no free God reigns over the world. Everything swims down the stream of blind, unalterable necessity. All freedom is but an illusion. Everything new is only that which is established in the old. It's a beautiful description. I mean, it's a sad description of how so many people look at the world and look at life. I cannot change. I cannot become better. This is me. And indeed, so much of our modern Western society, especially in the United States, is very heavily dwells on the idea of that it's not my fault. It's something else. It was medication I got when I was a kid. It was what my parents did to me when I was a kid. It was Twinkies. It was this. Anything but me. There is a book by Charles Sykes, S-Y-K-E-S, phenomenal book, called Nation of Victims. In Nation of Victims, he traces legally and psychologically the idea of everyone looking at themselves as a victim. Right? The guy, an FBI agent who embezzled money from the FBI. I mean, that's, you've got to be really stupid to do it. But he embezzles money from the FBI and he uses it to gamble. What is his defense? He is psychologically compelled by a disorder that he feels compelled to gamble with other people's money. A guy in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Department of Education used to come late every day to work. They fired him. He sued that they were discriminating against him. He had a disability. He had chronic lateness syndrome. Chronic lateness syndrome, CLS, Nebuch. This poor man was a member of a minority group that is severely discriminated against. Right? What about all of us with chronic lateness syndrome? The bank closes at 4 o'clock. What if I want to come late? Right? Work starts at 9, but I can't help it. Right? So there is this people who, you know, it's incredible the degree to which we look at someone else as the cause of our woes. Whereas free will just doesn't even appear, right? It doesn't appear on the horizon. You know, very often we only think of our personal responsibility. Well, we do often think of personal responsibility. When we do something good, then we want to be praised. We do something bad, not my fault, someone else's fault. We're not consistent. No one's really consistent. I remember I was in the Israeli army. I was in reserve duty. I was stationed in Bethlehem for 2 months. And when we came out of the base, the rule was that you had to have your weapon at the ready. So you had to have your gun with the magazine in it, right? Because it was a pretty dangerous area. So we're waiting for a hitch outside the base to get back home. and there's a bus stop about 100 metres down. So it was always a debate, do you stand at the Trumpiada to get a hitch, or do you stand at the bus stop? Because the Trumpiada is going to be more comfortable because you get a ride in someone's car. But on the other hand, if you're not at the bus stop, an egghead bus driver will not stop for you if you're not actually at the bus stop. If you're running for it, they'll slow down so as not to completely discourage you, right? But they will speed up when you don't get there in time, right? So I used to stand at the hitching hitching place, right? And when I hear the diesel engine on the bus, sprint like crazy, used to be able to do that for the bus stop and get the bus. So I'm standing there, guy comes out next, another soldier comes out, he's got his gun behind his back, a backpack over his gun, and a bag in each hand, sakit nylon in each hand. And I look at him and I say, you are a Barvaz Yoshev. He says, ma? I said, sitting duck, right? I said, look at you, you're supposed to have your gun at the range, it's going to take you 10 minutes to get your gun to the front, right? He says, if Hashem wants me to die, I'll die with the gun. If he doesn't want me to die, I don't need the gun. Before I had a chance to argue with him, I hear the motor of the bus. So I run for the bus stop. I made it. I get on the bus. Behind me, I hear this guy is getting on the bus with his bags and everything. I look around. I say to him, you ran for the bus. He says, of course. I say, what do you mean? If God wanted you to get the bus, you would have got it without running. And if he didn't want you to get the bus, running wouldn't help. So he says, Ani lo dati, I'm not religious. I said, 45 seconds ago, you were deeply religious. You know, like what happened, right? The bus came, that's it, goodbye to Jewish philosophy. The answer is that people use these arguments for convenience. You know what I mean? They feel like, I want to do something, right? They want to do it. You want to get praised for something? I did it, right? If it's something bad, my parents did it, my school did it, everyone except me. Sometimes it's true. Sometimes it's true. I'm not denying that there cannot be influences on the person, especially if they've suffered, right, abuse, etc., etc. No question about it. However, right, it's the extreme that I'm arguing against. And I think much of our society has gone to the extreme. In the Jewish calendar, we focus on the moon because we believe that the human being has the koach hachidush, the power of creation of the self. There is a song, I forgot who it is, I think it may have been Reba McEntire, country and western singer. It goes something like, I'm not going to sing it for you, don't worry, right? But it goes something like this: you are your own child, don't forget to be good. It's never too late to have a good childhood. You are your own child, don't forget to be good. It's never too late to have a good childhood, right? That is to say, you are your own child. Who creates you? We create ourselves by the actions that we do. No doubt Reba was referring here to Rashi at the beginning of Parshas Noach. The beginning of Parshas Noach, the Torah says, Eile toldois Noach, these are the children of Noach. Noach ish tzadik tamim haya b'doroisav. Noach was righteous, complete in his generations. Esay Elokim hisalech Noach, he walked with God. Vayolad Noach shosh banim, and Noach had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Clearly, it's a problem. And the Torah says, these are the children of Noach, and it takes about 10 words before I get to the kids. These are the children of Noach, who, by the way, was righteous, he walked with God, he was this, he was this, he was this. And then it tells me the kids. What's the explanation? What's going on here? So Rashi says, because Ikar tel voisav shel Adam, the main children of a person, are his own actions. Masim tovim. How does he know it's the main progeny? How do you know it's the main? Because it says it first. Before it tells me his children, Shem, Ham, and Yafet, it tells me his self, his righteousness. As the Maharal explains, because your children are not totally yours. There's three partners in every child: father, son, father, mother, and God. Right? So three partners in every child: father, mother, and God. Now, and Moshe Feinstein points out, that's only if you go back one generation. Right? If you go back two generations, then God's got a third of each of your parents, right? Which means you have to divide yourself into ninths, which means God's got 5/9, your parents, right? Your parents have only got 2/9. Of course, your grandparents, God also has a third of each of them. So you have to divide it further, which means, and the further you go back, right, then in terms of what my part in the child is almost zero. You know, it's like the asymptote, you know, okay, right? But God's portion is almost massive, right? Almost complete. But you see, however, in my actions, my free will actions, as we say, Hakol b'day shamayim, everything's in the hands of heaven, chutzme, except for yirat shamayim, fear of heaven, except for free will. So in that sense, the only true offspring My real essential offspring is myself. Myself. Who I am next year, next decade, tomorrow, etc., is totally, it's creation of my choices and my free will now. It's chidush creation. That is the essence of the time of the Jewish calendar. That's point number one. When is this supposed to finish? Well, we have time for point number two. 12:15 or 12:10 or something? 12:15. Okay, so we have time for point number two as well. Anyway, point number two is the following. In Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, source number two, Song of Songs says the following. Is point number one clear, by the way? Right. Okay, good. Right, now point number two is the following. It says in the Song of Songs, Kumilach ra'ayasi afasi ulechilach, arise, my beloved, my beautiful one, and let us go. Ki avar astav, winter has passed, hageshem chalaf halachlo, the rain is over. Hanitzanim niru ba'aretz, the blossoms appear in the land. Kol hator nishma ba'aretzenu, the voice of the tor, the turtle dove, right, which is actually, it's an onomatopoeic word, right? Tor is the sound the turtle dove makes. This was a famous mistake in one of the early versions of the King James Bible. This was translated as, the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. I guarantee in spring you don't hear turtles in Israel, right? In fact, turtles don't really make much of a noise anywhere, frankly. Right, so what this is referring to is the turtle dove, and tor is the voice, is the sound it makes. So the voice of the dove is heard in our land. The time, Eit HaZamir Higia, the time of singing has approached. Right, and it is the time that lovers will walk together. So what the beautiful verse, and what this is referring to, the Medrash says, is God speaking to the Jews in Egypt. God says to the Jews in Egypt, he says, arise, my beloved, my beautiful one, God says to the Jews, because the winter, i.e. the exile, has passed. The rain of your travail has gone. The time of spring, the blossoms appear in the land, your redemption has approached. Let us leave Egypt and go to the land of Israel. Very, very beautiful, very poetic. Right, so Rav Soloveitchik, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi, says the following. He says, normally we think of springtime and the time of Pesach and Nisan as being the time of redemption because that's when the Jews got out of Egypt. Is that how? I think that's probably most people think of Nisan as the time of redemption because that's when we got out of Egypt. He says, from this verse, we see the exact opposite. Think about this carefully. Why did God take us out of Egypt in that time of year? Because he said, now is the time of redemption. In other words, the fact that we got out of Egypt that time of year was because that time is redemption time. Is this, am I making myself clear? It's not that it's redemption time because that's when we got out of Egypt. We got out of Egypt because that is redemption time. God comes from the Jews. He looks at the, whatever, the papa, the watch, the blackberry. He says, time has come for redemption. Now is the time of redemption. Eit hazamir higia, right? Kol dodit. This is the time to come out of Egypt. So he tells us because when God created time, every single time has its own unique spiritual energy in every moment of time. Every month has its own unique spiritual component. And we see this in those who daven Nusach Sfarad. Right? I don't know if I'm Sfarad, I'm Hasidic, I know I don't look Hasidic, I'm Reform Hasidic. But okay, right, so, what we call basic, Hasidic basic, doesn't matter. Anyway, so in the Nusach Sfarad Siddur, you'll see on Rosh Chodesh, this is based on the Kabbalists, that every month has a different name of God for that month. And people are familiar with this idea, because the name of God is Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh, that's the name of creation. So Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh created time. So it's interesting, how many permutations are there, combinations of the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei? Well, you'll tell me, well, it's Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, it's four letters. So that's 4 factorial, right? Which is 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, right? That's 24. However, since 2 of the letters are the same, there's 2 Heys, how many, therefore, combinations could there be of these 4 letters? It's 4 factorial divided by 2, which is 12. Very simple, right? 12 possible ways to combine the letters of Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, God's name. And therefore, each month, there is a different combination of the letters of God's name that is the creative energy that sustains that time. when we do a mitzvah that is somehow connected to the time of that festival, etc., etc., what we're doing is we are capturing the sparks and the energy of that particular time that was already imbued in there from creation with that particular name of God. For example, the name of God for Nisan, the month of the redemption, is Yismechu Hashamayim V'Tagel Haaretz. You will note that the first letter of each of those words, let the heavens be happy and the earth rejoice, spells Yismechu Hashamayim V'Tagel Haaretz, is the name of God, Yudkei Vavkei, spelt incorrect in the normal form that you read it. So Nisan is the energy of Yismechu Hashamayim V'Tagel Haaretz. That means both the heaven and the earth rejoice, i.e. the physical world parallels the ideal spiritual world. Shamayim and Aretz parallel now. Why? Because the righteous are prospering, the evil are suffering, the Jews are being redeemed, miracles, we see God's presence in the world in an open way. This is how things should be. We see God's justice, we see God in the world, we see creation, we see these miracles. God's hand is obvious, the Jews coming out of Egypt. It is Yismechu Hashamayim, the Tagel Haaretz, the heaven and earth are dancing together. There's no discrepancy. No discrepancy between what we see and what we know. No discrepancy between what we experience and what we believe. It's all very, very beautifully written. The name of God is seen. What would be the opposite month of Nisan? It's when the name of God is spelt totally backwards. The month of Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, is the beginning of all of our downfalls. The Chet HaEgel, the worship of the golden calf, breaking of the tablets, so on and so forth. Right, so that actually, the name of God in that month is actually Hey Vav Hey Yud. It's alluded to when Haman said, Kol zeh, this einenu shaveh li, nothing is enough for me. Zeh, hey, einenu, ends with a vav, shaveh, ends with a hey, li, ends with a yud, the last letter of each of those words spells Hey, Vav, Kei, Yud, God's name in reverse order. God's name is still written on the world in Tammuz when we see tragedy and when we see destruction, but it's written, you have to read it, you have to be able to read it even though it's in reverse order and at the end of the letters. So there's a different energy in every month. And our purpose is the revelation of actually the name of God through each different time, whether it's in Tammuz by correcting what we did wrong, whether it's in Nisan by experiencing that Yismechu Hashamayim V'Tagel Haaretz. Every moment in time has its own unique creative energy, in which is our purpose is this revelation. I remember I spoke at the University of California in Santa Barbara, at Hillel House there, which is a unique experience because there's probably one of the most laid-back places I've ever been in my entire life. It was like a near-death experience speaking to these students. It was unbelievable. They're like sitting there half horizontal, like on the chairs. All you hear is occasionally like things like, dude, party. Party was the only verb I actually heard there. Right? Dude was the only form of address. So anyway, I was tempted to make conversation with one of the dudes there. And I said, excuse me? I said, dude, what are you majoring in? And he says, like, I said, no, precisely. And he says, dude? I said, doesn't matter. Right? And he says, like something between religion and philosophy. I said, between religion and philosophy? He says, yeah, totally. I say, well, what exactly is that? He says, like revelation. I said, I'm sorry? He says, like I'm majoring in revelation. Revelation? I said, like, dude, is that part of organic chemistry, man? So he says, no. Anyway, but what does it mean in Revelation? So anyway, I learned in high school, the Baal Shem Tov, founder of the Hasidic movement, says that you should learn from everything you experience. And I'm thinking to myself, if the Baal Shem Tov was with me here in Santa Barbara, what would he have learned from the dude? Right, so, and I thought to myself, I said to myself, righteous, it's a Zohar. The Zohar actually says that every one of us is majoring in revelation. It's actually, our purpose is really to reveal the name of God in every situation, every time, and every place. So when we do the mitzvahs of a particular time of the year, what we're really doing is revealing and capturing and tying into that spiritual energy of redemption, if it's on Pesach. of light versus darkness, if it's Hanukkah, of potential versus just using it right now, here and now, on Tu B'Shvat, and so on and so forth, and all the various times of year, recapturing, revealing, right, and tapping into that name of God that sustains that particular time. In fact, the Tikkuni Zohar says that the word mitzvah is a symbol of that. Because the word mitzvah, it says, is the name of God, which is both concealed and revealed. Right? Because the last two letters of the word mitzvah, commandment, right, what? Vav, hey, those are the last two letters of God's name. But the first two letters of mitzvah, mem, tzadik, are also God's name. But it's concealed. It's concealed in what we call atbash. What is atbash? Atbash is a system where the first letter of the alphabet, aleph, is replaced by Taf, the last letter, and Beit, the second letter, by the second last letter, Shin, and Gimel, third letter, by the third last letter, Resh. Is this clear? Right? So it's a substitution system. Mem is the tenth last letter, right? It's replaced by Yud, which is the tenth letter. Tzadi is the fifth last letter, it's replaced by He, which is the fifth letter. So really, it's God's name. Now, Atbash, by the way, is not just an arbitrary idea. It's based on a very deep idea, which is, we say in L'chadodi, Sof Maaseh B'machshava Techila. The end of action is the beginning of thought. What does that mean? The end of action in time, in our relationship, we have to understand that thoughts, the first thought equals the last action. The last thought equals the first action. What I mean by that is how Rav Moshe Shapiro explains it. You're an architect. You have an idea for a design. The first thought is the complete design, what it will look like when it's finished. But your first thought is only going to be realized at the very last action, right? You have to step down with your thoughts. What's the first action you do? The first action is very far from the first thought. The first action is getting a permit to build. That's not even close to the first thought. That's the last thought. So you go, what's the last thought you have is, okay, let's get a building permit. Okay? What's the, so, make myself, so the second last thought is, right, what type of area do we need? The second action is clearing the area. So on and so forth. So the first thought, which is the complete building, when will you see that? It's the last action. Sof maaseh, machshavat tchila. In that sense, the aleph, first thought, equals the taf, the last action. Our actions, the mitzvah, is that way which we're transforming the actions of the world to the first thought of creation, which is the revelation of God's name. So when we do a mitzvah, we're transforming, so to speak, the mem and the tzadi into a yud and a hey. Ki beka Hashem tsur olamim, the verse says, with yud hey, that name yud hey, Hashem created worlds, two worlds. Talmud says, he created the world to come with yud, and this world with hey. Why? Because what does yud do when you put it in front of a word? It's the future. Yihyeh, will be. When you put hey in front of the word, it makes it here and now. Ha! The definite article right here. So this world is the world of the here and now. Yihyeh, olam haba, is the world of future, will be. Kibaka, Hashem, tzur olamim, Hashem created these worlds with yud hey. The first two letters of God's name hidden in mitzvah are the names that created this world and the world to come, where we unite the here and now with the future. Because what we do at mitzvah, we're doing something here and now, which is connected to the world of Yihyeh, of the future world, and we're uniting it together. And through that, we're showing the name of Hashem in this world. So that the idea, really, of every time of our year is built in to create, and it manifests itself in different ways. So already at the beginning of the world, when God created the month, so to speak, of Nisan, that time, he put into it Yud-Heh and Vav-Heh Yismuchu HaShemayim V'Tagal HaAretz. How does that manifest itself physically? Springtime. How does it manifest itself historically? Pesach and other events that happen in that month as well. Right? So there's different manifestations of that one energy. Right, and therefore the Jewish calendar has to be adjusted to the seasons as well. It's because what we're doing is those seasons are connected to the spiritual underpinning. So our calendar is such that it incorporates both the idea of chidush, the idea of the looking at the moon and feeling the concept of renewal, recreation, free will, freedom, and also adjusting for the sun and the seasons and incorporating into it the energy that God planted, so to speak, into the cycle of creation that we recapture through doing the mitzvahs, that we reveal through doing the commandments, and that we are energized by tapping into that particular season of the particular time of the year. So that's a little bit of an intro to the calendar. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. And thank you very much for listening. Our next class, I think, will be on who invented the weekend anyway. We will talk about Shabbos and time. Thank you.